40 pounds.
If you ever get tired of them.
I might be after tonight.
I need tomatoes. Excellent. All right, good afternoon, everyone. This is an informal hearing on case numbers PU-21-364-365 and -366. It is about 3:00 on, let's see, September 1st, Wednesday, September 1st. And I want to call this meeting informal to order. I'm Commissioner Julie Fedorcheck, joined with my colleagues Randy Christman and Brian Crassus. So we do have a quorum here this morning, not that we're making any decisions. This is an informal hearing involving only undisputed facts. If there are any disputed facts, we will close the informal hearing and issue a notice of hearing. So I don't have any opening comments, but I will turn it over to my colleagues, see if they have any.
I also don't have any opening comments this afternoon.
Did I say this morning? I thought I said this afternoon. Well, I know Victor hears correctly, so this afternoon, 3:00. Brian, any opening comments this afternoon?
Nope, not this afternoon nor this morning.
All right, I'm so used to doing these meetings in the morning, maybe that's what it is. All right, so the applicant goes first. Jack, help us as we go through this proceeding. Are the cases all combined so that companies are going to talk about everything kind of intermixed? Or is it case by case?
No, this was consolidated, so we're going to be speaking about this in general.
Okay, very good.
All three of them together.
So the applicant goes first. Before starting, though, I want our staff to introduce themselves for the record, and then we'll go around the table and everyone can introduce themselves into the mic for the recording.
John Shu, and along with me today is Victor Shook.
Excellent. Go ahead.
Wes Cummins, CEO of Applied Blockchain.
Robert Endres, Otter Tail Power Company.
Bruce Gerhardsen, Otter Tail Power Company.
And Dave Prozic, Otter Tail Power Company.
All right, excellent. I think that's everyone. There's others in the room, but they'll have to introduce themselves if they say anything. Come to the mic, that's usually how we handle that. All right, any handouts and materials, as well as the audio recording of this proceeding, is now going to be considered evidence, or will be. I guess we'll get to that by the end. But with that, Brian, do you want to kick this off or just go straight to the company?
I think we can just go straight to the company and dive right in.
Bruce, do you want to take the lead?
I'll take the lead, but hand off very quickly.
Okay.
You know, I'm familiar with informal hearings in your forum, but our special guest, Mr. Wes Cummins, hasn't been here before. And so just, you know, for his benefit, I talked to him a little bit about that this is quite informal and that he'll give a presentation, and then we'll give a presentation. You certainly can ask questions of either of us along the way. And I, you know, we're going to let him go first because I think he's got the most interesting stuff, new to you, new to me in many respects. We have some stuff that's probably more familiar for our conversation here. But Wes, I guess with that introduction, thanks for coming.
Just be sure to, the mic doesn't need to be real close, but it needs to be on and just in the vicinity. Thank you.
That should be good. So thanks for having me today. I'm happy to be here, my first trip to Bismarck. And I'm the CEO of Applied Blockchain. I have a handout here in front of you. I'll flip through these slides, and if there's I'll keep talking about our company and what we're doing and our project, and just feel free to, you know, ask questions or stop me or tell me, you know, if there's a better way or a better direction you would like me to take.
And Wes, before I forget, oh, I see the answer. I didn't know if it's Cummins or.
Yeah, no G, it's just like the engine company.
Thanks.
Before we get started, sorry if I just make one general comment. I'm going to be relying very heavily on the company to ensure that the trade secret information, that we're notified if we're moving in that direction. So we can either take steps to subsequently step out and find what we can speak about, I guess, in an open meeting, or if there's an alternative that we have to find, like a late filing or something like that with protection, that we take that avenue as well.
Yeah, Commissioner Fedorcheck, can I just maybe get everybody comfortable on that? We've made a fair number of trade secret or confidential requests in this proceeding. It's, one of the reasons for it is that we don't often come in here and talk about a single customer. We usually come in here and talk about a class of customers or all of our customers. And it's, of course, important to us that all of our customers know that we do everything within our power to hold their private and confidential information private and confidential. And in this case, we don't really have that opportunity because it is a very single customer specific rate we've got. So it is requiring something a little bit unusual in terms of trying to give this customer all of the protections we would try to give all other customers, but at the same time give you an opportunity to reasonably address the issues that are in front of you. We are, to some degree, evolving that some of the information that is in the handout, for example, the name of the company, wasn't previously made public. And so we will adjust as we go, Mr. Hsu, the best of our ability, and we'll try and keep you sort of informed. And then when I get into my presentation, I'll give you a couple little sort of mile markers or guideposts on what we think is best to stay away from public dissemination and what's really appropriate for open forum. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Thank you so much.
Great. So I'll continue and move to the overview of our company. So this is an introduction to our company. We are a publicly traded, what I call a blockchain infrastructure company. And I'm going to give a quick description of what that really means. So for public companies or companies that want to operate in blockchain or cryptocurrencies, in my opinion right now, there's really a couple of ways to have a business, a cash-generating business in this industry, and one is infrastructure, which is what we're doing. So think of infrastructure as being mining, which I'll describe what that is, or hosting, which is what we're here for today. And then the other primary area that I think for a company that's publicly traded is finance. It's platform, which is like Coinbase, which is trading or lending or against hardware or some other kind of finance or brokerage type transaction. There's a lot of other things that are going on in this ecosystem, a lot of software development, a lot of applications that are bringing, you know, being brought, new applications. But those are the business model for those is not really there yet. So that's not what we or really anyone else in the public domain is involved in. So I'm gonna talk mostly about the infrastructure, which is what we're doing. So we started as a mining company. We launched a partnership with Sparkpool and a company called General Mining Research earlier this year. And Sparkpool is the largest Ethereum mining company or Ethereum mining pool in the world. And so pools basically, they do kind of what it sounds like. They pool together a lot of miners and they run the software. And it basically ensures that you, for the amount of work you do for your contribution to the network, you're rewarded with basically the same percentage. And so Sparkpool is the largest. That when we joined them, they were 25% of the world hash rate for Ethereum specifically, not Bitcoin. And then General Mining Research had deployed hundreds of millions of dollars worth of mining hardware. So in both Ethereum and Bitcoin, I'm going to talk a little bit about what mining is. It's something, it's the terminology you usually see, and it's used, it really just refers to people that are companies, entities that have deployed capital to basically buy what are effectively computer servers. And then they run the servers, which verify transactions on the network, add blocks to the chain, and for that they're rewarded with tokens. So if you're doing Bitcoin, you're rewarded with Bitcoin tokens, and if you're doing Ethereum, and then there's a lot of these other networks that are out there that are a lot of different tokens. But it's really the two primary, number one is Bitcoin, and then number two is Ethereum. And so right now we are operating as an Ethereum miner. Our GPUs, which are NVIDIA GPUs, are hosted in a facility in upstate New York. And we did that in partnership with Sparkpool and GMR. And so our second addition to our business is actually building the facilities that will host these miners. So it'll be some of our own computer hardware, and then it'll be some third-party, mostly third-party. So people will pay us, almost like a data center, like an Equinix-type business, where you would pay to run your data servers, your web server for the internet. And so that's the facility that we want to build out, that we're already starting to build out in Jamestown. And so for me, when I think about what our company is for blockchain and for crypto, you know, you should think of it about the infrastructure. So there's, you know, think about it very simply, like we're picks and shovels, right? We're picks and shovels for the gold rush. We want to be the infrastructure guys. Or when you think about the internet, the age of the internet, and you think about all the companies that came and went and like who ended up being dominant, We're not making that bet. We're making the bet of being kind of the networking gear company, the guy that does the infrastructure, because they all do pretty well. It's not maybe as rewarding as being the guy who, you know, strikes it rich in the gold rush or is the, you know, ends up being Amazon. But this way we don't end up being AOL either, right? So So that's really basically what we're building. We want to build out this infrastructure facility in Jamestown. And to put a scale on this, this first facility, let me flip to some more slides. So hopefully that was a good overview of what we're doing. And then before I go into the facility in Jamestown, let me move to the leadership, because this is important, and I'll explain why it's important. I'm not important. I'm the top name there, but we have some people in this slide, Etienne Snyman, Nick Phillips specifically, that have built these facilities out before here in the U.S. And the reason that they're important is the talent pool for this is extremely small in the U.S. There's been very few facilities built out. Most of the hash rate in the world for these networks is in China and in other countries. And there's only been a handful of facilities built in the U.S. and maybe 12 people that have headed these up to build them. And so Etienne, he built the facility in Medicine Hat, Alberta for Hut 8, which is a Canadian publicly traded mining company. And then Nick, he was one of the first people at a company called Core Scientific, which is the largest hosting company in the U.S. They're actually coming public for a little over $4 billion merger transaction with a SPAC. And so these guys have built these facilities before. It's really hard to find this talent. And I'm going to talk about where we are in the process. So we were able to grab these guys back kind of in the June and May timeframe when we decided to make this move, when kind of the market opened up for us to do this. And so I'm really happy that we've been able to collect real talent here, because the talent pool is really small. And so now I'm going to go to our first site in Jamestown and kind of what this means and what I think eventually it could mean, not just for Jamestown, but the state of North Dakota. So we built a facility, 100 megawatts of power, and what that will do, that we expect this to cost us around $30 million to build out. We're using, all, for the most part, almost exclusively, in the state or even local to Jamestown contractors and service people to do this, so that's great. But what this will bring eventually, so we build the facility. Think of these as pretty big steel buildings that are going to just house servers, and they're going to run 24/7, and they're going to do computational math on the blockchain, and whatever network people want to run on. But I would assume that most of this is going to be Bitcoin. So let's just talk in terms of that. So for 100 megawatts, we'll host about 30,000 of the latest and greatest Bitmain antminers, and that's the best equipment. I didn't mention at the start, Bitmain invested in our last round. Probably the most well-known name in Bitcoin for sure, and they have about 75% market share for the hardware. So they build the semiconductors and actually the full unit for the servers, and that equipment is actually typically on long lead times and hard to get. So it'll host 30,000 of these machines, which ends up being, I'm talking some strange terms, of everyone talks about hash rate, which is kind of the number of guesses that you make on the network to solve these problems. So 30,000 of these machines will do about 3 exahash. And to put that in perspective for this facility, the entire global Bitcoin network right now is doing about 120 exahash. So we're going to be, just under 3% of the full global network for Bitcoin, which I think is pretty impressive for one facility in Jamestown, North Dakota. And then, by the time we're done, and in our partnership with Otter Tail, we hope to build out more like 15 exahash and be over 10% of the global hash rate for the Bitcoin network right here in North Dakota. So I think that's important. And I'm obviously excited about the technology, and I think it's kind of a Web 3.0 transactional technology. I know everyone thinks about speculating on tokens, but I really think it's a potentially kind of a Web 3.0 really important technology for the future for transactional networks. So the first site is some specifics. It will, on the next slide, you'll see it'll host the 30,000 of the ASIC miners, which is about $200 million worth of hardware that go into this single site. So you're looking, $230 million plus into the initial site. It'll create jobs in Jamestown. So you're going to have a staff on site here 24/7, mostly technical. So you're going to have some obviously electrical, but when you're dealing with 30,000 of these servers, you want to, and you're going to have to, some of them are going to come offline. They're going to need servicing, you're going to get repairs. There's going to be software programming. There's a lot to do on site, and you're going to need to run this 24/7, 365. So, we think it'll be 30 plus jobs that'll be ongoing outside of the construction that will be on site. The next slide is just I think one of the important parts that we're building into this with Otter Tail is the curtailment aspect. So we recognize, you know, that this is a very large load, and we hope to get this up and running fairly quickly. But we've agreed that we would curtail if requested from Otter Tail with 15 minutes notice. They have the ability to shut us down if we don't shut it down, but we do have the capability from a software perspective to shut down all of our servers in a very short amount of time. And if we can do it ourselves without them doing it, we can bring them back up really, really quickly. But I did want to point that out. We have that ability. I think that's been, you know, as I've been around Jamestown myself, that's been one of the primary concerns that people have asked about, you know, is what does this do for their power? And I think it won't do anything for their power.
Wes, on that question, do you have a limit to how many hours you can be shut down? Like, you can be shut down within 15 minutes for how long?
That's a question for, I don't remember that.
We may want to have that one in a more confidential setting, don't mind, because that has some operational implications, okay. I think, for...
And you don't have your own on-site power generation? You would just
no.
be gone?
No, right. we're using the current power generation. Oh, that's the right slide. In Jamestown, I myself have spent some time in Jamestown, but I would say generally we've had a lot of excitement around this project in Jamestown. We're collaborating with the university there on a blockchain course that we'll have guest speakers at. You know, we've had a fair amount of community involvement already. Some of the gentlemen here with in the room, we had kind of an impromptu town hall back in July that they invited people probably in, you know, with like 3 hours of notice. I was surprised, you know, a lot of people showed up. I gave a 5-minute talk kind of telling what we did. And I thought that would be the end of it. We ended up in almost an hour Q&A session in the room, and all very positive, great questions, actually. So it was fun. But, you know, kind of universally, I can give some funny anecdotes, but universally that everyone there has been very helpful. The chairman of the township that we're going to be in has been extraordinarily helpful. He's kind of trying to move everything he can to get this project going. But everyone in Jamestown has been really welcoming and helpful to us. And I think we're trying to be a very good member of that community. And it will be doing a groundbreaking is what we're planning on the 14th of September in Jamestown. So I've been very excited about that. And the reception has just been fantastic. We have this is a tech business. I think this is kind of the next generation of networking, of technology, and we're bringing that to Jamestown, and I think that's a great opportunity for a lot of people there, and then also for the university being there as well, and they've embraced it. I think that's really it for my presentation, but it's been a great reception so far. We're excited to kick this off.
Thank you, Chair Fedorchuk. Mr. Cummins, of course, covered many, many issues. I'll try and cover really the regulatory issues that, again, are more familiar to you. And then you can certainly ask both of us questions or anybody in the room questions. So I have an agenda, and it's in a separate PowerPoint. If you look at it, it begins with an agenda. And I do want to introduce Bob Endres, who's relatively new to our staff. Bob is sitting to my right. Bob is an attorney. He's in the process of being licensed in North Dakota. He submitted a pro hoc vice to be with me today, but Bob will be somebody that you see from time to time, so I thought I'd take the opportunity to introduce him. There are a number of other Otter Tail representatives here. I won't introduce all of them, or it'll take too long, and I think many of them you know. The agenda starts with confidentiality, and we already talked about that a little bit. I might add a little bit more on it. Again, really, this is one of those things that it's a unique situation when you have to come in and talk about a individual customer's business. We don't typically do that. We tend to, in rate proceedings and things like that, if there are questions that get to any individual customer's service, we generally look for the same kinds of confidential treatment. This one just has a lot of different pieces and parts to it, and we appreciate the work that you've all done to understand how to maybe navigate that reasonably. I hope that this is something of a celebration in that it is a success. This is something we have set out to do, not just Otter Tail, but your staff and the commission. It is going to go back to a rate per program that was approved in 2018, and this was essentially the intent was to attract certain large customers that we saw the potential for, not only in the data area, but certainly data was one of those things we saw. We saw that some other utilities had attracted Google and other types of customers through creative, negotiated things to meet their needs. And so we brought to the commission as part of our last rate case, I believe it was that, or was it a separate proceeding? I can't remember. It was a separate proceeding. Okay, pardon me. But in 2018, the commission reviewed and approved this approach, and it is an approach that we have complied with, and we'll get into that a little bit. There's a service area agreement in this instance with the neighboring cooperative, and I believe there's a representative here today, and I don't mean to have you, and you certainly can come up. And we didn't get a chance to talk beforehand, so if you want to come up and speak at all, make sure that you feel welcome. And then we'll talk, I guess, a little bit more about the rate review that we do to determine if this is in the public interest, and then also the terms of the electric service agreement, all of which are sort of part and parcel to have we derived an appropriate rate and terms of service that reasonably create the opportunity that we had sought to create, which was to lower costs for all customers, at the same time not increase risk in an unreasonable way. So we'll talk about that, and if I were you, those would be the things I'd be very interested in. The confidentiality slide, like I said, we've talked about it a bit. There's a long sort of boring fine print thing, which is meant to give you a clear written explanation of some of the reason that we ask for this treatment, probably the primary of which is that at a certain level, if we take an individual customer and their information isn't to some degree and a reasonable degree held in confidence, it can inhibit their ability to compete in their industry, and it can compromise our ability to attract them. And we have to say, this is a customer we had to attract to the area. This wasn't a customer that said, I want to locate in a particular specific spot, and I'm going to take service at that specific spot, and who can I take service from? This is a customer that we sought in communication with this customer and in as part of our goals under the Super LGS rate to attract a customer to North Dakota as was conceived at that time. We're quite convinced that if we didn't have these opportunities, we wouldn't have been able to attract a customer like this. There's a number of things that I'll just point out on that slide of confidentiality, the kinds of things that we want to maintain in confidence because they're particular to this customer, and they could disadvantage us in the in negotiations with the next customer. It could disadvantage this customer in competing in its own business. So we can, if you just kind of use that as a little bit of your mile markers as to when you want to get into a question on that, maybe we'll just pause and Mr. Shu can tell us how do we want to do that to maintain confidence. Again, we don't want to keep in confidence anything that's really important and that isn't serving the needs of the customer and our reasons for keeping things in confidence. Summary of our request, it's really three cases. The primary ones relate to the customer, but one very important one relates to the neighboring cooperative. And so on this slide, number four, we outline the dockets that are involved and really just what are our requests. We are seeking approval of the service area agreement, and then we're also seeking approval of the rate that is really in compliance with the earlier approved rate schedule, and then also the electric service agreement with the specific terms. The service area agreement. Again, I've mentioned some of this, but the customer is desirous of taking our service. We in Northern Plains, not me, but the representatives of Otter Tail and Northern Plains conferred on the subject. I know that you are well aware that these public convenience and necessity matters can get lengthy and costly. Lengthy was a deal killer here. We had a need to resolve this issue rapidly, and I was just really pleased with both our staff and the staff of Northern Plains to work through and really, you know, sort of move heaven and earth to get together, to communicate and to arrive at something that was mutually acceptable, in order that we could continue with the goal of attracting this customer to the state. The service area agreement, I think, is laid out there. There are some unique provisions because of the circumstances. And again, if you have questions on that, it can be asked of both of us. I do know that when we filed this, this was largely treated as confidential. It does not need to be blanket confidential. There's actually only a couple of provisions in it that we would ask maintain confidence on. So we're refiling that, I think, isn't that right, Bob, to sort of give you the right amount of confidential treatment. In fact, how could we do that if it wasn't made public in some respect? So, but it really, it is unique to this particular customer. I think that the discussions between our company and the neighboring cooperative was to just resolve the service to this particular location. It doesn't go beyond that, so it really is related to this one sole point of interconnection. It is adjacent to our substation. That's the next slide. And I think that that is some of what makes service to this customer somewhat more advantageous than they could find in other parts of the globe. That we had infrastructure and capacity at the location. And so that allows us to bring a relatively large customer into service, as long as we could come up with the other electric service agreement terms, such as interruptibility, without a lot of costly infrastructure additions. That is often the thing that can kind of kill it for trying to add something to some area, is the lack of a sufficient capacity in the location. We have it, and we're going to make it useful. I think the other points in there I've already spoke to on slide 6. There's a little illustration there. I hope it's not too fuzzy, but I think the point is that the red block is the location that Mr. Cummins was speaking about, and the sort of the infrastructure you can see there is the substation. So you can see it's immediately adjacent to and sort of surrounding. The rate schedule, which is what's discussed on slide 7, if you look at the eligibility criteria, those are the things we look for. And it does require a fairly unique customer, because we need them to be big and have a high load factor. And I know that you understand the efficiency of a high load factor, is that a customer that pays for a lot of kilowatt hours over a long period of time is going to reduce the per kilowatt hour costs of service. And it is just really a matter of economies of scale. It helps us to pay for, especially when we don't have a lot of infrastructure necessary to serve the additional demand of the customer. That can be a very efficient thing for our entire system, not just for this customer, but our other customers then can benefit from that, in a sense, spreading the costs of the system more broadly. So that's the goal that we set out when we got the commission to when we got the commission support for the large general service rate schedule in 2018. There's other criteria here. We did require a written ESA. That was actually a requirement of the rate schedule, and it anticipated that there would be unique characteristics depending upon the operation. The rate schedule could be utilized by other kinds of businesses. There could be agricultural processing facility or a manufacturing facility. As long as they met the criteria, they may qualify. And then the question would be, what are the particular terms of the electric service agreement that we feel and they feel are appropriate and necessary to sort of achieve the goals, which is reducing costs without inordinate amount of increased risk. The rate is unique. In fact, I'd say it's quite innovative. I'm unaware of any other utility that's offered the same kind of rate that is based on a recognition that we have sort of some base, what I'll call embedded costs, and that when we add a big customer, we have an increase to the incremental cost, meaning that there's new costs associated with the new customer that are different from the costs that are sort of residing already on our system. And so if we serve them using the rates that were published in the book, they would be, in a sense, taking an assumed share of growing the same pie in exactly the same way as we have historically. With this customer, because of their unique needs, we can grow the pie incrementally in a more cost-effective way that is unique and sufficient for the customer, in a way that's more cost-effective, and then that gets recognized in the rates. So when we see the thing that says, what would they pay under the ordinary rates, we'd have to recognize, too, that that isn't exactly what the right rate would be when you add a big customer to an existing relatively small system. So the next slide, and you can come back to any questions on here. I'm skipping over some of the specific bullets, and I don't mean to omit them, but the next slide on slide 8, the intent was to attract new load, which is beneficial to Otter Tail and our system, meaning, again, driving the incremental cost down per unit, and then also to the economic benefit of our communities, which is part of our mission statement, is to improve the lives of the people in our communities. So we hope that this achieves both of those goals. We should say that we think there's a lot of public interest benefit in this service. And so we've got Jamestown area. I think I wasn't able to attend the event Wes talked about, but I do think it was an exciting time for an opportunity for Jamestown. Slide 9 has a little bit more on the rate and how it complies with the previous approved rate schedule. The ESA is important to it in that it addresses certain things like interruptibility, which would not be necessary in the under the rate schedule, but because of the unique characteristics of this customer, in order to manage the risk, the interruptibility becomes essential. And we can talk about that if you would like, but essentially the calculuses that we use, calculi, whatever it is, the math we did recognized that if we don't have some ability to dispatch the customer, there's a potential that we could have to dispatch generation in a way that it would be unoptimal. So by being allowed to dispatch the customer and the algorithms that were used to determine how much risk mitigation that gives us, we were very comfortable with the ESA terms, and that's one of the ways we can, in a sense, moderate any risk associated with and capture all of those benefits, of which there are many, economic benefits. So we've based the rate in part on the embedded costs, in part on the incremental costs, meaning that we're not serving them straight on incremental. That would mean there would be no benefit to other customers. We do it in part based upon the embedded and in part based upon the incremental, and that allows for some additional revenue to contribute to the costs of other customers. And so we'll talk about that in, well, I guess, in the final two bullets there. In the near term, customers would expect to see new forecasted kilowatt hours in their rider rates. So right now we have a rider rate in North Dakota for the generation rider. It's essentially paying for our Astoria power plant. And by adding blockchain, the number of increments that that will be spread over will be many more, and the per increment cost to any customer will go down. So that's how we benefit. That's a really, I think, a clear example of how we benefit existing customers by adding greater increments with a customer like this one. Longer term, we expect that we will have fewer, or at least it'll be longer before we need to increase base rates. And when we do, those base rates will be lower for the same reasons. And that's the spread of some of this benefit comes through the riders and some comes through the base rates. So we feel like this is such a benefit for our other customers. That's a benefit for our company, too. I don't want to minimize that. The benefit for our company is that we're a small company. We don't grow very much, and I think you all have certainly know us well enough to know that. We serve very small towns that don't have a lot of sort of what I'll call organic growth with manufacturing and other things. And so this is kind of a unique opportunity for us to grow. And when we grow, we can create a more efficient electrical system. We can attract even more, we hope, people that are interested in investing in our communities in North Dakota. The additional benefits, the interruptible load on the slide 10. You can see the benefit of the interruptible load. It's quite flexible. And one thing I would say is it's not only the gross amount of interruption, it's the ability to interrupt with a great amount of flexibility. And that means that the response time is short and that the amount you curtail can be precisely dialed in. So it isn't everything's off or everything's on. Those things have incremental independent value, the ability to be flexible, sort of to follow the needs of the system as the system requires. That is an independent value.
Bruce?
Yes.
So when you say no additional capacity resource additions needed, so is that like your company didn't need to have any, this didn't change your requirements under MISO or anybody else to add this load?
Only very in a very small way, and I think okay. There's a very small number of demand that's added to the system, okay? And I think that's in your filing materials. It's a single-digit number. So
yeah.
While there's 100 megawatts of capability, they can use up to 100 megawatts, that if we call on them, we can reduce all the way down to that smaller number. That means that to the extent the resource adequacy requirements would otherwise for a large customer like this require us to have a lot in reserves for those peak days, we now can satisfy those peak days by curtailment rather than by dispatching a generator. So when we think in terms of like dispatchable load, this is a perfect example. We can dispatch the load in a beneficial way that reduces costs. And those are the costs you reduce to other customers. So when other customers have to pay for more power plants, their costs go up, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so if one can reduce the demands on the system, one can reduce or can increase the amount of consumption without increasing the costs.
Okay, so if I want to talk more about the terms of the interruptibility, that needs to go offline.
Yeah, I think your questions will likely get more particular to operations on both sides from us and from
okay.
the customer.
We'll hold that as one
if you don't
item mind. That we might want to come back to in a closed session.
I'm going to move to slide 11. And I have probably staff in the room that's saying there you've missed an important part. So when at some point I'll ask them, did I miss any important parts? We use our general rules and regs. I think there's some question, staff had questions about the initial deposits we require from a new customer. I will just say we can talk about that, but those are following our general rules and regs. We have handled the incremental additional investment to begin service the same way we'd do it for any other customer, say an ethanol plant or something like that. So we can talk about how that works. It's somewhat of the regulatory history. It's been around for a long time. It's sort of an odd thing that isn't exactly intuitive, so I'll be happy to walk through that because I'm also an odd thing from the history of regulation. So the specific terms were negotiated, but they are consistent with us protecting the public interest and sort of walking the expected lines that we would walk when the original service, the original rate schedule is approved. And we'll talk about it if we can, and if you have questions when we're able. I guess the recap on that is, again, I go back to the fact that this was our goal and one that we understood, you know, the commission supported, and we know they support, which is that this is for beneficial growth in an emerging industry that I think if we can, you know, get some footholds on this industry, this is going to be a long-term benefit for the area. That was the potential that we saw, and I'm so proud of my coworkers that we're able to find, talk to, and address the issues that were related to this customer so that we could attract them. I think the primary benefits are economic, not only the local economies, but literally to our system. We will have a better system at lower cost with this customer. There are things we will be able to do at lower cost, and I just can't think, I mean, I think that is the primary objective that we sought to achieve. I think that's the end of my presentation. The requests that we have in front of you are pretty straightforward.
So Bruce, you used some kind of different terminology, but did I understand you right that any potential advance payments regarding Otter Tail's infrastructure costs to hook this up, and then if there are any potential reimbursements of that as time goes, that those can be discussed publicly?
They can, as you know, actually
not the amounts, but
yeah, if we can stay away from the amounts, the concepts are absolutely open. They're in our rate book, and I'll be happy to walk through that.
And what about the length of time of
the 3-year revenue guarantee versus the that is in our rate book, and I can talk about that.
Okay, so well, I guess that is the question: is the customer paying the amount in advance that the infrastructure development will cost?
Essentially, they pay a deposit that, as long as they take service at the volumes they intend for the period of time that's required in our rate book, they get that money back. The money that they pay up front is really something that we require of new customers in some cases. If there's a risk that they could not, take service for a year and go away. And so, go ahead.
And the reimbursement of that deposit is in annual installments, correct? Not all loaded at the end?
I don't recall if it is. I think it tapers down is my recollection. I don't remember if it's in an annual installment or periodically.
Does it? And there's an interest component on the deposit, correct?
That is correct.
And so, and that's a variable rate based on a formula.
That's correct.
And so we can't know what the exact total is going to be at this point, but
that's correct.
My question as I read this all was, it looked like the reimbursement's a lot more than the deposit. And so does that mean that balances out the last year and can't exceed what the deposit was plus interest?
That is correct. The intent would be that it be the amount that had been, in a sense, contributed at the beginning, deposited, with an interest rate pursuant to the, I think it's a statutory rate in North Dakota.
Yeah.
That's my understanding. I don't know the specific numbers or the specific math to say did that work out exactly, but you're right. It would have been forecasted based upon some assumed interest rate over that time.
Okay.
I believe that's how it's supposed to work.
I just want to assure myself that there wasn't a big difference in the amount that
yeah.
the other customers are left to pay.
That is correct. That is the intent.
Okay. Thank you.
Brian, do you have any?
I don't. I don't have any questions.
Okay.
I appreciate just a comment. I appreciate the new information that you're able to put forth. And it's very helpful.
One thought I had as you're kind of walking through this, so I understand and agree that there's probably no generation needed to serve this new load. How about transmission? So the one thing that's kind of popping into my mind is MISO will do transmission studies to look at either economic or reliability upgrades necessary. Do you anticipate anything like that coming as a result of this? I guess, and kind of along
no,
with
I appreciate that.
The substation that we're hooking up to, what sort of feeders does that have? What size lines?
Mr. Shook, my technical knowledge is not that deep, so I may have to call on others for
sure.
of that. It's my understanding that they have investigated that through normal transmission studies and other studies to determine whether there's adequate capacity. I may ask for any of these people that have better knowledge than me on that subject. There's adequate capacity. Also, the interruptibility also reduces, the demand. The demand is what we generally plan for. And so it doesn't impose demand-based capacity additions either at the transmission level or at the generation level. I think I'm speaking correctly, and I'm getting a nod from those with greater knowledge. So it's that smaller number, which is not an inconsequential number. I don't want to say that. But that smaller number is what the capacity is evaluated based on.
Sure.
Is that helpful?
Yep, and I agree. So for the capacity and for the reliability, it's probably not going to cause a needed upgrade? Just kind of thinking about the economic upgrades.
There's one other thing that actually occurs, and that is there is a larger allocation to Otter Tail as a member of MISO for the large, you know, the MISO Schedule 26A, for those of you that are keeping track. The very large, we will get a somewhat larger share of the allocations of those big infrastructure costs because we're a little bigger. You know, we were less than 1%. I think we're probably still less than 1% of MISO, but a bigger percent. And we get a little bit bigger allocation of that. That's been considered in the rate assessment. So any additional, that's part of the incremental cost to serve that we assessed. And we said we needed to make sure we at least get the additional incremental cost served, and then this a bit more to help pay for the system. Sure. And so that is the other place that I'm aware of it,
okay.
And that would continue to be evaluated. So if we had any other economic evaluations, the rate schedule does allow for us to continually evaluate whether whether at any point we exceed the marginal cost or exceed the embedded cost. I'm sorry, that the marginal cost exceeds the embedded cost. And we can adjust the rate to the customer. The customer's aware of that. That's how the published rate ensures that our other customers won't end up subsidizing anybody.
So just to zero in on that a little bit more, I believe you're at 0.7% now, the MISO allocation.
That sounds about right.
Would it move to 0.75, 0.8, but less than 1%?
I haven't done the math.
We do have an estimate of that dollar amount that appears in the filing. Confidential portions.
Okay, I can do the math.
And the percent that we change in our total, it's a very small amount still.
Okay. Is it in the filing or in the calculation spreadsheet? I would expect it in the spreadsheet. I don't recall seeing it in the filing itself.
And
you think it is in the filing?
The amount, the expected allocation from MISO, the costs, mm-hmm. Not the percentage change.
Anybody else have questions for this portion?
Maybe one. You can just tell me if you feel it's inappropriate. This doesn't really have to do with our role in this, but I will tell you, since you said you're somewhat new to North Dakota, as people who are elected, people ask us questions and they don't always follow specifically our jurisdictional guidelines. You mentioned a few things that I think people will inquire about and probably won't inquire of you who they should and will inquire of us. Are you comfortable with, and tell me if I wrote one of these down wrong, the 100 megawatts, the $30 million to build out 30,000 machines,
mm-hmm.
the $200 million of value of those machines, and the 30-plus jobs with us? Talking about that with folks.
Yeah, I'm absolutely comfortable.
And on the 30-plus jobs, those are jobs that would be stationed in Jamestown
Correct.
Or Stetson County region?
Correct. Correct.
And a lot of times people think of jobs as, okay, what type of jobs?
Sure.
Do you have kind of a estimate of average salary of 30 jobs or something like that?
So I don't have that estimate, but you should think of these as being, you know, more technical type of jobs,
okay.
which we'll be servicing. So we have a commitment also with our partner Bitmain to open a service facility here in North Dakota, and it might be, you know, co-located with us in Jamestown, or it might be, you know, somewhere else, but somewhere here. And then they will train and help us train people that will work specifically on that hardware. So I'm just including what I would expect for ours, but when you think about pay, you know, some of these will be, there's some security jobs, right? And those are probably going to be lower paying security jobs of just someone to be there kind of 24/7, right? And then the tech support people are going to be jobs that pay, you know, somewhere in the neighborhood of $45,000 to, you know, $65,000 per year, probably with a salary with benefits. So I think it'll be fairly good paying jobs.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Absolutely.
And these makes it easier in saying, well, that's not our jurisdiction.
Yep.
And just out of curiosity, these are these all on-site jobs?
For the most part, they'll be on-site. And not necessarily this site. You know, there might be a repair center that's elsewhere. But for the most part, in the Jamestown site, yes.
Okay, good. It's not jurisdictional to the PSC in terms of where they're located. It was a curiosity
okay.
question, but appreciate the answer.
Okay. So I would like to talk about the terms of the interruptibility some. So how should we proceed with that, Jack?
Sure, and maybe we should take a minute and just kind of reorient ourselves before we either go into closed session or see if we can answer this in a different manner, if that works.
Yeah.
But before we go into that, is if I just ask a couple questions?
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure. So with service area agreements, what item that we're supposed to approve, we're supposed to look at whether this is in the public interest and ultimately the fact that Northern and Otter Tail both are in agreement, that would indicate that clearly there's some sort of public interest operationally.
Mm-hmm.
Are there other aspects that you would probably have the commission point to in determining that this mm-hmm. service area agreement is in fact in the public interest?
There are, actually, you have a good record because we already have a service area agreement with Northern Plains that I probably should have mentioned when I brought this up in and around the Jamestown area, and this is really just creating I think it's probably more of an addendum. Maybe we even called it that. I don't remember.
No, it's separate, but it's in the same spirit.
Yeah, so it's really that it's in furtherance of the same arrangements that we have had approved by you in the past
mm-hmm.
in working through whether we could reasonably arrive at a solution for when we are in these sort of areas near facilities that belong to both of us, how do we work that out? We worked that out in a way that we thought was fair and equitable to both parties. And what else could I tell you? Otter Tail does have, I think the location of the substation is a very important factor. I think the factor that any other provisions are consistent with the earlier agreement, I believe, with the exception of some recognition to the cooperative for any lost opportunity, which was really, to some degree, in order to facilitate a quick resolution, which meant we were going to, in a sense, trip over ourselves and the customer might go away. And we needed to prevent that. And so what I think we did is we arrived at something that was acceptable to all parties that prevented that.
Sure. So ultimately, we could look at the fact that it's mutually beneficial to the ratepayers as well as the members of the cooperative.
I believe so.
Okay.
Yes, and I maybe ask that they'd speak.
Come to the mic, please. Thanks.
Thanks. Yeah, Steve Shawnick with Otter Tail Power. I think from a development perspective, this land suits them very, very well. And it doesn't necessarily suit any other type of business that well. So on both sides, I can't speak for the co-op, but we're looking at it not necessarily taking land that would have been manufacturing land or anything else. So that, I think, is very much in the public benefit.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
Yeah, thanks, Steve.
And I guess the other question would relate to, I guess our regulatory framework as it comes to unjust discrimination and preference, and inherently contract rates are preferential. To a degree, and so I guess the aspect that is, are there other aspects aside from the side that you're saying this would have a net benefit to all the system costs in its contributions? Are there other things besides that we would point to saying this is really just on preference,
mm-hmm.
from if that makes sense?
Absolutely. I mean, I think the fact that we have done a pretty rigorous analysis of the incremental costs to
mm-hmm.
sort of say what is the cost change to the system,
sure.
and are we capturing enough? If we weren't, that would be, I think, where you would suggest it was not just and reasonable. I think then there's a question of what is the right amount for a customer to contribute beyond that. And that gets to be a difficult question of regulatory economics, as I'm sure you know.
Absolutely.
In this case, I think the answer is our customers would want us to do this if it attracts the customers. I mean, and I should say they would want us to do this from the economic sense, that to the degree we're trying to sort of dial in what doesn't cause them to go away and keeps them here,
mm-hmm.
we're trying to arrive at the greatest amount of contribution we can reasonably achieve. And so while there is that component in the terms of the service of this rate schedule, that was what was anticipated, and it was recognized that that was what it was going to take to attract beneficial customers to the region.
Gotcha. And this might be a question for Victor, but the You guys had a proprietary model that you discussed. Is that a, that was a model that staff had reviewed?
It is. Okay. Oh, I don't know if you're asking me or
something. Sure.
Yes, staff has reviewed the model both initially, and there's an annual filing requirement with the assumptions, and then an additional requirement that the updated customer-specific data be input into the model and filed with this application, which it has been, and I've reviewed as well.
Sure, and I'm trying to go back to my recollection. Did the commission previously review this in its entirety, or was this just a staff review of the model?
The model the model itself was approved as part of the SLGS tariff filing back in 2018.
That's I just want to make sure.
I can't say whether they've all made themselves familiar with the spreadsheet.
It's sure.
Quite complex, but
I could state it to you line by line.
Well, let's have line five, please.
That's okay. Confidential.
That was my recollection. I just want to make sure that that was clear, that was something the commission had previously approved. And a couple of questions for Wes, if you don't mind. So I guess as part of your business model, you'll be hosting, and from that aspect, whether it be outside investors such as individuals or just more corporations and groups investing in these mining rigs within your business model?
Yes, that's okay. Correct.
So in essence, would they be owning those mining rigs within the...
Correct.
Okay, gotcha. I guess from that standpoint, is that... I guess I've heard, and granted, I have a very superficial understanding of this, that how profitable the mining is largely dependent on, I'm assuming, either the energy costs or, on the alternative, the price of the crypto at that moment in time.
So there's really three main components, right?
Sure.
It's your operating cost, which is primarily energy. And energy is about 50% of your operating cost.
Okay.
The other big determining factors are obviously the price of the tokens, right? So price of Bitcoin or Ethereum. And then the last factor is the network difficulty or the hash rate. So as hash rate goes up, that means more people competing for kind of the same number of tokens, mining rewards that will be rewarded every day. So those are the three main items. And at the current rate, mining is extremely profitable, but it's also extremely volatile.
Mm-hmm.
So for us, when we think about our business, it's, you know, some of it is our own mining, and then there's this really stable, you know, let other people take the risk component to it.
Gotcha. I'm assuming the competition with the hash rate goes up, the more expensive the crypto goes.
Correct.
Right? Okay.
Correct.
Would you say that there's more insulation in your business model from the fact that you're hosting as opposed to actually owning?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Okay, and do you think that would probably lend itself to more longevity to your business model or less risk?
I think longevity from multiple aspects, you know, how I talked about earlier, us not betting on whether we're going to be AOL or Amazon, right? No matter what token or network ends up eventually winning, you know, 30 years from now, because we're building sites that'll last for 100 years, right? So whichever one wins, there's going to still need to be infrastructure. And so we're not just building a business as look, we're 100% in on Bitcoin or Ethereum or anything like that. We're building a system that says, hey, you guys decide what you want to mine. We're here to host it. We're setting up the facility. We're going to service. And for that, we take a fee. So it makes, I think, longevity both from not making that bet, but then also diversity of a big customer base, so that if someone goes out of business or goes bankrupt doing this, right, we have, you know, 100 or 200 or 1,000 other customers.
Sure. Okay. Those are the questions I have. Thank you.
Sure.
Okay. So, do you want me to just ask my questions and see if they'll answer them?
I guess my concern would be that if you ask the questions, they may automatically reveal some of the trade secret.
Right.
And so maybe we could just take a couple minutes and have a conversation and decide how to proceed. If everyone's
so
comfortable
with that. Okay. So we'll take a couple minute break.
Sure. Thank you.
All right. Maybe come back at 5 after? 2,
okay.
3 after?
We'll just stand up. 5
minutes.
Okay. I wonder if it would be easier for us to go.
Back on. Excellent. Okay, we're back in session for the informal hearing on case number PU21-364, 365, and 366. So we've had a good open discussion with all the parties on this. We've come to a topic of interest, myself in particular, on some of the terms of the interruptibility that Jack and I talked about. I just feel like there's enough questions that I think are going to require a little bit of a give and take that I think it would be more efficient and better for the record to have that discussion openly versus exchanging filings after the meeting, et cetera. So I would like to move into the closed session format. And so I've got a little template here that I'll follow for doing that. This hearing is subject to open meeting laws. However, Otito Power Company has provided an application for trade secret protection for specific information in case numbers PU-21-364-365-366. The legal authority for closing this meeting is North Dakota Century Code Chapter 4404, including NDCC 4404-18.4 and 47-25.1-01. Subsection 4. ND Admin Code Section 6902-0908 provides that if specific disclosure of confidential information is necessary during testimony, sufficient notice must be provided to clear the hearing room of those that are not authorized to participate. At this time, a motion would be in order to discuss the case in closed session rather than in an open meeting, and I'm going to make that motion myself. I move the Commission close the hearing to receive protected testimony for case numbers PU-21-364, 21-365, and 21-366.
Second.
Thank you. I have a motion and a second. Is there any discussion on the motion?
If I may, Madam Chair, there's one issue I would like to clarify, and that's the who is authorized to participate. This is trade secret information that is specific to the parties. So of course the company as a party is authorized to be in and to discuss this. Staff as well under our administrative rules are allowed to as well. But others that are not either staff or subject to this agreement would be, of course, needing to leave. They would not be authorized under this trade secret unless specifically authorized separately by the commission.
Okay. Thank you for that clarification, Jack. Any other discussion? All right, then I will do a roll call vote. I vote aye. Randy?
Aye.
Brian?
Aye.
Thank you. All right, with that, the motion is approved. The closed portion of the meeting will be recorded, and all members of the commission are reminded to limit their discussion during the closed hearing to the announced topic, which I already announced. Any collective decision, collective commitment, or other final action by the commission must occur after it reconvenes in an open meeting, unless final action is specifically required by law to be taken during the closed portion of the meeting. We will now ask the members of the public who are attending the meeting to leave the room. We anticipate adjourning the closed portion of the meeting and reconvening the open portion at approximately 4:30. All right, the minutes will show that the closed, we're closed. We'll come back in and reconvene in about approximately 15 minutes. Good to go, excellent. Okay, we will begin the public session of the, or the open session of the hearing again. Maybe Jack, you can open the door and invite the public back into the room. The minutes will show that the closed hearing was adjourned at 4:30. The public has been invited to return to the meeting. We're now back in open session. If there are any motions that need to be handled immediately, they're in order now, but we aren't taking any action, so I wouldn't anticipate any motions. Is there any other questions that anybody wants to have or discussion on this, any of these cases?
I did think of one more.
Great.
How far is this facility from the existing line between Otter Tail and the co-op's, the service area?
I'll have one of our area reps that knows the geography a little better to give you the mileage.
Sure. Chris Waltz with Otter Tail Power here. It's about six miles north of the existing boundary north of Jamestown.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Any other issues to discuss? Staff, Jack, Victor, you good?
Just two forms that you
ready. Okay, we'll take care of those.
No, just I've been through all the details, the model. I have no concerns from staff's perspective because I'm curious to know if you all would want like a work session to discuss any particular terms of approval of.
At this point, I don't anticipate needing any work sessions, but.
I don't have a desire for a work session.
Okay. At this point, I do not.
Okay. Then, in the interest of time, I would intend to have orders prepared for approval of all three cases for the September 22nd agenda.
Okay. Sounds good. Then we'll look for that. And if somebody wants a work session, we could certainly work one in between now and then as well. So, okay. Well, with that, we've gone through a number of documents here. Do any of the parties object to those becoming part of the record as well as our audio recording?
No objection.
No objection. I do have one question for the company, if that's all right.
Okay.
Chair. So we received, of course, a number of filings, trade secret protection, and items as well. Would the company be looking to withdraw those documents then and then subsequently make a refiling? Because if that's the case, then we would probably just send them back to you. And
yeah, we can do that post-haste. Sure. I don't think it'll take long for us to sort of limit the redactions as we've discussed. Okay. And we'll just resubmit them, and you can, return the envelopes.
Okay, sounds good.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
All right. With that, it looks like we have a pretty solid record, and that is the information we'll be using to make a decision on this case. If there's nothing else, this informal hearing is closed. Thanks, everyone, for your time today.